and its furies rage today. Crushing hope that we cherish so dear.
The price you pay for that loaf of bread or next winter's heating bill, those costs are related to the weather. And that's the topic of conversation this week on Jet Streaming.
Keep on the sunny side, always on the sunny side. Keep on the sunny side of life. It will help us every day. It will brighten all the way if we'll keep on the sunny side of life.
That's a nice way to begin Jet Streaming, a podcast devoted to the weather and climatology produced by Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Kathy Werzer, along with Dr. Mark Seeley from the University of Minnesota and Craig Edwards, Minnesota Public Radio meteorologist. Hi, guys.
Good morning, Kathy. It is a sunny day today.
It is. How are you doing, Craig?
Good day to chat, I think, about what the market will hold for us in the coming months.
Well, we're going to get there in just a second. We're celebrating, by the way, our 12th podcast this week, and we figured a dozen podcasts is worth celebrating. At the end of the program, we're going to draw a winner in our weather radio contest. That was a tough question, by the way, Mark.
Well, we wanted people to have to do a little digging.
Yeah, they had to do a little digging, and I think we're going to see who won this fine weather radio. We'll talk about that just in a few minutes from now. Well, interesting news this week, Mark and Craig, wheat prices hit an 11-year high at the Minneapolis Grain Exchange, and high prices have also been seen in Kansas City and the Chicago exchanges, too. Poor weather in the southern plains is causing the price spikes. Globally, Russia and Ukraine are also having big problems with their wheat crops. We wanted to talk about the ramifications of the weather on things like commodity prices and oil and natural gas prices, something, Mark, that many of us don't really think about.
That's true, but it's operating continuously in the background of very, very weather-sensitive enterprises there.
Joining us right now is Brian Ridland of Country Hedging. It's a commodities brokerage firm. It's a division of CHS, one of the nation's largest farmer-owned co-ops. Brian, how are you?
Great, Kathy. Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Mm-hmm, no problem.
You know, give us a sense of how weather-sensitive your business is.
Well, I guess I could probably use the last couple of days as an example. We came into Sunday afternoon, Sunday evening, and the market really focused tremendously right now on growing conditions and on weather. And we come in Sunday night and hear talk about some ridging maybe setting up in the deferred forecast. And just like that, our markets are up 10, 15 cents in corn and soybeans, up 15, 20 cents in wheat. And then we come into Monday's market yesterday. Of course, we're trading futures just about 24 hours a day now. So we take a little break Monday morning. We start the markets up again at 9:30, and the market, of course, takes off some more. And again, a lot of this based on the weather forecast, not really what's going on currently. And we live and die by that pretty much this time of year, wondering when the next rain event's going to come through. Sometimes focusing on the nearby weather, but a lot of times trying to focus on what that deferred forecast is trying to tell us. And again, continuing that story, overnight it seems like the information maybe has changed a little bit, less view of a ridge setting up, and the markets are down a little bit today now.
Say, Brian, Mark Seeley here. If I'm reading between the lines there, at least for Northern Hemisphere growing regions, would the June, July, and August period be more or less the period of peak volatility in price due to weather, or am I off base there?
No, Mark, that's pretty much on target. I like to say the silly season, as we sometimes call it, will start sometimes even as late as in late of February, early in March. And if it happens then, it's probably more based on South American weather conditions, with, of course, Brazil and Argentina being two major grain producers in the Southern Hemisphere and becoming larger each year, especially Brazil. But traditionally, I would say, between late May, and usually the crops are all in the ground by then, and then the June weather and July weather. And then the old the farmers will tell you that the bean crop is made in August with any showers that we can get in, say, the first half of August. So you're pretty much right on with that.
Marcus, Craig Edwards here. And what I believe I heard you say was that the market reacts more to the forecast than what the actual weather has occurred. And that seems pretty risky with these forecasts in the summer months being, you know, like 50-50 at best on these long-term 5- to 10-day forecasts, because I'm seeing the new 8- to 14-day forecasts for pretty much late June. They're talking about a cool, wet pattern setting up over at least the nation's midsection, not so much east of the Mississippi, but through the plains and into the Minnesota area.
Yeah, we live that roller coaster, Craig. It's really unbelievable sometimes how we try to trade a forecast that might be 8 or 10 or as many as 14 days out. And it does prove to be quite a market mover.
You know, you mentioned, Brian, the term ridging. Can you help me out with that?
Well, the way the market looks at ridging is, and I'm sure the weather guys can correct this, is setting up some high pressure over certain areas of the country, basically blocking out rainfall, not allowing it to get in. And ridge in our business is usually a bullish or a price moving upward type term. And with the Eastern Corn Belt really being tremendously wet late last year, most over the winter, and then even this spring, now all of a sudden we've gone to maybe a little bit of a net drying pattern the last couple of weeks. And when they start talking about ridging setting up over the Eastern Corn Belt, basically talking Illinois East, the market very sensitive to that. Not super sensitive yet, but very sensitive to the idea that we can get, we sometimes call them the domes of doom. Setting up over an area, blocking out rain, and baking the crops.
Brian, this is a little bit of a deviation, but I can't help but ask. There's so many things that go into market fluctuations. Weather is perhaps at the top of the pyramid here, but I was wondering, USDA APHIS program, the Animal and Plant Health Inspection Services, they put out routine reports that alert us to threats of like soybean aphid or Asian soybean rust or European corn borer. Do their reports sometimes come into play in terms of drastically altering these market prices?
I think historically, Mark, there's probably more of a minute effect from those things. Probably bigger impact, again, this time of year, is weather and the deviations in forecasts. Also, every Monday afternoon, the USDA will put out their crop condition numbers. In fact, we got those, of course, yesterday afternoon. And it's kind of a thing where the market tries to anticipate what the government's going to say, whether it's a crop report that was out yesterday morning or it's the crop condition report that was out in the afternoon. And the market likes to try to anticipate, and, you know, hence we call it a futures market because it's trying to anticipate things in the future. But the market likes to anticipate what they're going to say, and sometimes when we don't get what we think, the market will react, you know, up or down to those differences. And yesterday we were looking for the crop conditions to go backwards a little bit, and we got some of that, but we didn't get it as to the tune that everybody had thought, and hence that was a little bit negative for the market. And then we also had, like I said, the overnight tweak in the forecast that kind of took some of the ridginess, and I'm not even sure if that's a word, but the ridginess out of the forecast, and that added to the price weakness here today.
I'm curious as to the sources for weather information. Could you say somebody's taking this ridginess out of the forecast? And I think the meteorologists are all looking at the same computer models.
Right.
Are there sources? How many sources of information do you have for weather news or weather forecast? And is there a favorite out there that people say, well, when two or three of them line up or when this person says this, that's the one we're going to go with?
Well, you know, Craig, everybody's looking for that guy that's going to be right, you know. And it's kind of a running joke in the business. I hear people tell me, and we listen and we read tons of them, of course, with the internet and email and things like that. There is no shortage of opinions when it comes to weather. And I know since I got in the business in 83, there was multitude more of privates that you can subscribe to and read and listen to. But is there a hot one? I have some people telling me, and I try to follow all of them, and that's a tough job. But I have some people telling me that they think freeze notice has been about as right on as anybody. But there's a bunch of them out there. And, of course, as soon as you find the guy that you think is right, then he starts to be wrong. It makes our job even tougher because we're here to try and help people manage risk and maybe sell some crops. And, of course, we all want to get the best price we can, and we want to be good consultants and risk management advisors along that line. But it really makes it tough this time of year. I mean, we have to have an extra bottle of Rolaid sitting at the desk here.
Well, you know, we've been concentrating our remarks on the grain markets, but your company also deals with the futures regarding energy, the energy field, Brian. And I wondered, what effect do heat wave forecasts and tropical storm forecasts have on these energy commodities? Do they cause large market fluctuations?
Oh, yes. I think, of course, your best example of that, Mark, would be Katrina from a couple summers ago here and what she did to refining capacities and infrastructure down there. And of course, the hurricane season started here just the 1st of June, and we've seen predictions of X amount of number, I think it's 17 or something like that, of hurricanes that are expected this year, and how many of them are expected to be severe, and I'm sure that's a little bit of a guess to a long-range forecast. Very critical to oil futures and, of course, risk management there. On the natural gas side, probably more about heat, because my understanding continues to be that when we get into high energy demand, electricity for air conditioning, all those type of things, a lot of these backup systems will go to natural gas. And really, looking at the natural gas chart here today, natural gas has been in pretty much in a holding pattern price-wise in the futures market in New York since about March. We made some real lows back in January, right before the cold weather kicked in. Warm weather in the winter, cool weather in the spring and summer tends to mean cheap natural gas prices. And conversely, if we start to get a heat wave into the, I would say, the midsection in the eastern part of the United States, we tend to see natural gas respond to that. Oil probably more tied to the sensitivity around hurricanes and also, unfortunately, anything to do with, you know, terrorism.
I'd like to follow up with that because I've got an observation here, and you could tell me if I'm wrong, but as soon as we start seeing something in the tropics that gets a name to it, and it has the potential to come on shore, we start seeing the speculation that oil prices are going to go up.
Yes.
So all of a sudden, something shows up in the Gulf, and the gas price goes up 10 cents before something's even happened to a refinery. Is that a good observation, or am I wrong with that?
I think, Craig, since we went through Katrina and, of course, the aftermath to that, I think there's a real sensitivity to that. Right or wrong, it happens. I think, was it Barry was the tropical storm or the depression or whatever that hit the Georgia-Florida coast. Even when that came on the radar screen, the market hiccuped. I mean, it was nervous about it. It moved a little higher, and that was just a dress rehearsal for what we think or what the forecasts say we're going to go through this summer. So this just gets more interesting.
You know, Brian, final question here, as we talk about commodities and the energy market and that kind of thing, how much can your clients lose based on a bad weather forecast?
Well, that's going to depend, Kathy, on the size of your position.
Okay.
There's people speculate every day in this business. I mean, a farmer, if he, in my opinion, if he's growing a crop and doesn't have it sold to somebody, that's a form of speculation by definition. And there's other people that like going to the casino or going to New York or Chicago Board of Trade invite that risk. This is the time of year when volatility or the nervousness or the pressure cooker aspect of the market is about as high and as keen as you can get. And historically, I would say the volatility is much more pronounced and as a measurement is much higher than years prior. So if you are willing to take that risk, there's risk and there's reward. I know people that can do very well in it. And, of course, there's for everybody that wins, there's going to be somebody that's going to lose too. And it can be quite sizable depending on how much position they take on.
And depending on what Mother Nature wants to do, too.
Exactly. And just looking at the forecast change overnight, you have to anticipate that, and a lot of it has to be just guessing, and you have to guess right.
All right. Brian Ridlon, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Very much. Thank you very much also. It was my pleasure also.
Very interesting.
Yeah. Thank you. Brian is with Country Hedging, a commodities brokerage firm affiliated with CHS Incorporated, one of the country's largest farmer-owned cooperatives.
In through my veins. High, low pressure in the back of my brain, Mr. Weatherman, why's my baby so cold?
That's a cute song, too. We're always on the lookout for interesting stories relating to the weather, and this one comes from Wisconsin. Did you hear about this? Evidently, the FBI wants to find whoever has been sending in false severe weather reports to the National Weather Service. The reports are coming through an online form on the National Weather Service website, and the reports have included Milwaukee, La Crosse, and Chicago. And the fake reports have led to mistakenly issued weather warnings. And Craig, is a former National Weather Service chief meteorologist, how could this happen?
Well, it can happen because the internet is able to communicate information unpoliced. And so what the National Weather Service has done in the Twin Cities, when I was there, we had spotters that we were screened before we allowed them to send us a spotter report. But some of the weather offices allow direct internet email that can give a spotter report. And I talked to a source yesterday that they think they have narrowed down the area from where those reports are coming from. And I know in Indianapolis, when I was there, when we just could get the phone calls for severe weather, we had one person that knew that severe weather warnings were based on 60-mile-an-hour winds. So every time a storm went by, and this was before Doppler radar, he would report 60-mile-an-hour winds, and we would say, well, that could be a valid report, but now we've learned that try to validate that and confirm that with another observation. And I think what the National Weather Service has got to do is assess the environment, assess the radar. Is this feasible? Is it plausible that this storm is producing this type of condition? And then respond to that. Of course, Kathy, that takes time, and when time is valuable during severe weather warnings. So I think what's happened is the Weather Service has erred on the side of safety, and then finally they're reacting to these bogus rogue reports that are coming in. And let this be a lesson to all people that think they want to try to do this in the future.
Yeah, it occurs to me, Craig, that it's really important that the type of people that do take the spotter training from the Weather Service and get involved, that you almost have to develop a covenant with the Weather Service that you're going to follow the rules and behave according to certain standards, because this is, you know, analogous to, say, the false alarm on a bomb threat in a school or something. It deploys so much activity in the public sector from the standpoint of not just the National Weather Service, but emergency managers and all kinds of things, that it really is terribly distressing that we have people out there that that do this.
Yeah, Mark. Like I say, at the Twin Cities office, we have this eSpotter program, and these people that want to report to us electronically, they're screened. We know who they are, and all the spotters that report to us that have been trained in Skywarn spotting, Todd Krause has administrated that with a spotter number, an identification number, and not quite a code, but we know who those people are. Unfortunately, sometimes you get people coming straight through the systems through with a phone call that are relaying report, and we had one of those in the Twin Cities a couple years ago, and we were able to track down to some consistency in that report, and it was verified that this person was giving us bogus reports. And so I think he tried changing his name, but we were onto that, and so we were reacting to that. So you got to be on your toes when people are reporting severe weather, and you got to respond quickly to that.
Which leads me to this final question here, Craig. What's the criteria used to issue warnings?
Well, the National Weather Service has dime-size hail, and I've been fighting for 20 years to get that up to about nickel-size hail, because quite honestly, I didn't think dime was sufficient to cause damage, but there people told me otherwise. So it's dime-size hail and or winds of 60 miles an hour. We call it 50 knots, which is about 58 miles an hour, but about 60-mile-an-hour wind gust. And so those two criteria, 60-mile-an-hour winds and hail dime size or greater, are severe thunderstorm warning criteria.
And the hail comes from a spotter, obviously.
Yeah, the hail report comes from a spotter, but the radar has algorithms that estimate the size of the hail, and so we have an idea what size hail may be falling with that storm. The storms on Sunday produce hail up to 2 3/4 inches. Some reports, a lot of reports, of 1 inch to 1 1/4 inch. And what I was looking at, the hail algorithms on that day were overestimating the hail size by about 20%. So pretty much the radar is a good tool to get an idea where the severe storm is and give you an idea how big the hail formation might be. But you really have to have the ground truth to know what's going on with the hail size.
And the case here, you need to have true ground truth, as it were.
Yeah, as otherwise we're just speculating. And sometimes you get these reports and you sort of scratch your head and says, 2 1/2 inch diameter hail, where did that come from? And more times than not, Kathy, it's been right. So we've got to go with the fact that when a report comes in, that it's correct until it's proven incorrect.
Okay. Well, as we mentioned, the FBI is looking for this person. And this story has certainly caught the attention of news organizations around the country. And we'll update the story as need be here on Jet Streaming.
You are my sunshine, my only sunshine. You make me happy when skies are gray. You never know, dear, how much I love you. Please don't take my sunshine away.
As the Jet Streaming podcast audience grows, so do the questions from listeners. We have this one from Michael from Minneapolis. He says he is a weather junkie. Welcome to the club, Michael. And he loves Jet Streaming. And he writes, it's June 7th, 2007, 10:30 in the morning. We have a low-pressure system sitting over us. My barometer in northeast Minneapolis says 2,900 inches. And the National Weather Service says 28.307. Now, normally, the two barometers are very close. Can they be that different? Is the pressure reported at sea level? What does that mean? Mark Seeley, can you help Michael?
I think so. I think what Michael got his hands on, Kathy, was an altimeter report from MSP International Airport, the Twin Cities National Airport, which provides that for pilots so that they know what the adjusted for elevation reading of the barometer should be. And I think that that 28.3 was what he intercepted. Now, most what's out there for the public consumption is a mean sea level adjusted barometric pressure reading. And if you pull reports off the internet, you want to make sure you're reading a METAR report. METAR is the code. Because all of those are adjusted for sea level. For example, I examined that specific date and time and found around the Twin Cities, for Michael, the barometric pressure adjusted for sea level readings ranged in a rather tight range from 29.08 to 29.13. So his Northeast Minneapolis barometer was off a little bit, but not that much, really. And if you adjusted the MSP International Airport reading of 29.11 inches for the altimeter adjustment, because MSP is at 840 feet above sea level, you would indeed have gotten about a 28.3 reading for MSP Airport at that hour on that date. But what he was getting was the adjustment that's made for pilots to know what the reading is at this at the elevation of the airport, and he wasn't getting the true so-called METAR data.
Okay, good. Don't you love Craig when Mark talks technical?
Yeah, I love that. And he, I was waiting for him to throw in. There's also pressure reported in millibars, and I'm glad we didn't go there because that would have been another twist in the story about the barometric pressure.
Yeah, well, we didn't want to make this a 40-minute podcast.
Yeah.
By the way, thank you, Michael, for sending us that question. We're almost out of time, but this is, as I mentioned, our 12th edition of Jet Streaming. 12 podcasts is something to celebrate, and we held a contest asking a tough weather-related question, with the winner getting a Storm Tracker weather alert radio. It operates on batteries, or you can hand crank it. Okay,
very
that was the
nice
hand crank. Thank you so much. It has a flashlight when you crank it. There you go. And a radio, of course, as I mentioned, and it's a cell phone charger all in one. Kind of nifty from the Weather Channel. Mark, the question was, what was it?
It was, what is the record for the longest-lived named tropical storm in the North Atlantic?
Craig, do you know what the answer is? Don't say it if you do.
No, I don't know what the answer is.
Okay. All right. So, let's see. We received a number of responses here. We put all the right answers in a hat, and our producer, Larissa Anderson, reached in blindfolded and pulled out. I think we need a drum roll here. It's pretty exciting, isn't it? Mark, who is the winner?
And here we go. Cecilia Andes of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Wow.
Very astute. She must have done a little digging to come up with that. But the answer is 28 days from August 3 to September 4 of 1899, Hurricane San Ciriaco roamed the North Atlantic and, in fact, inflicted serious damage on Puerto Rico during its life cycle, but it lasted 28 days.
Wow.
I can't imagine if we had 28 days under a storm threat down in the Gulf region of the U.S. today, people would be having nervous breakdowns.
I'd hate to think about the price of gas.
Yeah, no kidding. Given our conversation with Brian.
Yeah.
Cecilia, good work. There we go. Studio audience clapping for Cecilia. We'll send the weather radio your way, Cecilia. Thanks, everyone, for entering and for supporting Jet Streaming. We'll have to do something even better for the six-month mark. Goodness.
There you go.
I don't know what I'm going to do about that. Mark and Craig, thanks to you.
Thank you very much, Kathy.
Fun as always.
We appreciate that. If you have a question, by the way, for the crew here at Jet Streaming, go to minnesotapublicradio.org and click on Jet Streaming in the podcast section and leave your comment or question there. I'm Kathy Werzer. We'll be back next week. In the meantime, keep your eyes on the sky.
Wow. Take the places for as long as it's talking with you.